red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Time to ask yourself what you believe.
Mass murder, torture, perjury, embezzlement, fraud, deception, treason. These are just a few of your many crimes against humanity. You will not win this war, for you are fighting the very essence of humanity.
Hi, welcome to Truth or Talk. I'm April Bowden.
Christine Henry.
Please check out our website, truthortalk.com. We are in one location now. We still have Conspiracy Realist t-shirts available. If you buy 3 shirts, you can get a copy of our friend Liam Sheff's book, Official Stories, which we highly recommend. If you went to public school and you learned history, we want you to learn the true history and get Liam's book. And on today's show, it's a milestone show for us because it's our 50th show.
Woo!
Number 50. Yeah. So we wanted to bring back our favorite person, Sarah Sotomayor. Sarah was one of our first interviews, and we have become such good friends, and we want to bring her on as often as we can, as often as she's available to talk about stuff because she's so smart. And so, Sarah, please welcome Sarah to the show. She's going to be with us all day. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, hey guys. How's it going?
Nothing more. How are you guys?
Good.
Great.
Fantastic.
Give us your blog spot again, or you're on WordPress. Give us the location of that.
Okay, sarahshealingjourney.wordpress.com.
That's right. And so have you written anything recently?
I have not. I've been, I recently was in the hospital around May, and it took a while to recover from that, but that's another story for another day, but working on getting more out there.
Yeah, it's hard. I know I haven't been writing a lot either because, I mean, we all have our own personal blogs, and I have mine, Aiden's recovery.blogspot.com, and where I write about, you know, what's going on with autism and vaccine injury, which is what you write about as well, and Sarah, your own personal vaccine injury from Gardasil.
Right.
And so that, you know, we share a lot of information between us because you know, I experienced it via my son, and then you've experienced it personally.
Yeah.
So I always really value your insight because he's pre-verbal, shall I say, because I know that he will talk someday, but he's at the moment pre-verbal, and so I like to hear from you because you can really tell me what it's like, and you can describe how it feels, and you have such a good insight. You really know your body, like you really blew me away that one time when you said, yeah, I can really feel my leaky gut sometimes. And I was like, wow, you can feel it?
Yeah.
I was, you know, blown away by that because I don't know. I mean, I assume my son can feel it because he can't tell me, but he tells me he communicates in other ways other than verbally. So I assume that he does, like when he wants to put pressure on his tummy and when he's, you know, having other kinds of issues. So
yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that all kids who have autism, even if they can't talk, like it's a specific feeling. Like, no, like if your stomach's upset or cramps, like it just does not touch leaky gut at all. It's very specific.
And your memory is so, I mean, me and Verstine were like blown away when we interviewed you. And you remembered everything from when you were 14, like every single incident, you remembered every drug they put you on. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Was it Verstine?
Yeah,
were we like blown away? We were like,
we were taking notes.
Because you remembered everything. It was like, I mean, it was incredible.
The doctors didn't really like me too much then either. Because I would question them. I would be like, well, I really don't feel well right now, and I'm noticing this sensitivity to fries or potatoes in general. And he just laughed it off. And I'm like, well, isn't that a sign of an allergic reaction to something?
Well, he couldn't
answer my question.
He laughed it off because you weren't appealing to his authority.
Exactly.
Sure, which is where we're going to talk about fallacies today. It's a fallacy, an appeal to authority. We're going to talk about with Jan Ervin. He's our guest today.
Woo!
absolutely no bullshit kind of guy. Really good.
Right.
Absolutely. I've learned a lot from him, and I'm continuing to learn from him. He's very giving with his knowledge. I really admire and respect people who know a lot of things, but they're giving with it. They want to bring people up to their level. you know, instead of looking be like, I know more than you. And, you know, they're people that are knowledgeable about a lot of things, but, you know, they kind of look down on people. And I don't feel like he's like that. He's the opposite. So I feel like he's all about, like, bringing people up to his level and getting people to think and, you know, like a teacher.
No, but he's, because that's their whole model. We'll ask him about that. On his website, Gnostic Media, they talk about the teaching method of the trivium. So that's something we'll definitely have him describe and explain to everybody, and how that I agree. Yeah, he's giving with the knowledge and teaching people how to think for themselves, which is what we're all supposed to do. And we are often taught not to think for ourselves and just to blindly follow authority. You know? Racine, remember that time when, and I don't know if you saw this, Sarah, but we had when we interviewed Rob Schneider, we posted it on our page, and some douchebag comes on and he's like, oh, you guys have Rob Schneider, the star of The Animal, and on our side, the vaccine, pro-vaccine side, we have Nobel Prize laureates. And I was like, oh, wow, do they give away Nobel Prize laureates for trolling on the internet? Because you'd be up for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, look at fucking Obama got one. He didn't do shit for... that's questionable. I think Alfred Nobel would, like, roll over in his grave because the Nobel Prizes were, you know, created to promote peace and to make the human race prosper, you know?
And Al Gore...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I can't go back that far and really cite exactly, you know, each prize winner, what they have and haven't done. But so far, as far as, like, Al Gore and Obama, they're the fucking opposite of what, it, you know, what the Nobel
Prize is. Jonas Salk, the inventor of the polio vaccine. But, I mean, I didn't even want to get into it with him because he's that much of a loser that he just, you know, is bowing to a Nobel just because the guy has a Nobel laureate. It's like, I don't even want to waste my time trying to explain how that is just bullshit, you know. It wasn't even worth it because Rob Schneider is a comedian that he doesn't possess intelligence and critical thought, which he obviously does. He was very knowledgeable about vaccines and had researched it, unlike this idiot. On that note, we are going to take a short break, and when we get back, we're going to have Jan Irvin from Gnostic Media. So please stay tuned. Short break.
Today, Bellmouth's going to be talking about the New World Order. Was that Dorothy? You believe the official story of 9/11? You're a f***ing idiot, Dorothy. Everybody knows it was an intelligence operation carried out by Dick Cheney. That's why we go to shop.truthandtees.com. What's that, Dorothy? They don't have shirts and fish sizes? shop.truthandtees.com and get your conspiracy realist gear today so people won't think you're a f***ing idiot.
Jan Irvin is the founder of Gnostic Media, an open source independent media that pulls you outside of the box and into the heart of cognizance itself. Here the word Gnostic pertains to knowledge and not necessarily dogmatic Gnostic teachings. The word Gnostic has its origins in the word knowledge or to know. Topics of investigation include education and the seven liberal arts, the trivium and quadrivium, the mystery schools, mythology, theology, psychedelics, mind control, archaeoastronomy, politics, economics, philosophy, physics, consciousness, diet, health, law, and natural law, human rights, and much more. By bringing together leading academic and independent scholars and providing them with a platform to present their ideas and research in full, Gnostic Media is able to help facilitate and deepen people's understanding in these related fields, not only for the listening audience, but for everyone involved. Jan has a YouTube channel, Gnostic Media, and his website can be found at GnosticMedia.com. Please welcome Jan Irvin to the show. Hello, Jan. What's up? How are you?
Hey, Jan. Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good.
Thanks for being on. I love
having you. Yeah, we're fans of your show, so.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So definitely. So first of all, we want
to
know.
You guys should keep that to yourselves, though. Don't tell anyone.
Okay. All right. Well, this is just between us.
You'll get all the haters. You know, it's like if you start exposing like citations and stuff that people can actually check and verify, they get really upset at you. Just warning you. Just letting you know.
Oh, that ship's already sailed. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, what is your background, and you know, how did Gnostic Media come into fruition?
Well, my background originally, let's see, I did sales a little bit. I hated that. And
selling what?
Selling newspapers. I worked for a company out in L.A. helping them do their hiring for a while. I was also a network engineer for a number of years, and I ran a computer store for a number of years. And thankfully, I did that because it's almost impossible to run your own show and stuff without an IT background. But, you know, so pretty much just kind of, you know, management and a little bit of sales and mostly IT. You know, my education was primarily IT and electronics. And, you know, I was one of these kids that hated high school, dropped out, finished 12th grade at home. I graduated, walked with my class, but I hadn't been to school for like 5 or 6 months. I couldn't stand being at school. And came across it was probably in maybe 1992 or 1991. I was hanging out with a friend, and we heard that Jack Hare, the father of the hemp movement, was recruiting people for the California Hemp Initiative. So my friend and I went out there, and we met him. And then the next morning he caught one of his coordinators for this region stealing, and so he calls me up the day after I met him, and he says, "I don't have any coordinators. You're the only person I know. You're it." And so that kind of started, you know, it was like one of those conversations when you see people on the movies, you know, when they're looking at the handset, when they're setting it down, you know, like really staring at it, like, what did I just do? So it was one of those kind of moments where staring at the handset while I'm putting it back down, going, what the hell did I just get myself into? So then I found myself being the Inland Empire coordinator for the California Hemp Initiative, which is Riverside and San Bernardino counties in Southern California. And then later on, that's when we switched to the Medical Marijuana Initiative, Prop 215. I worked on that as well as, you know, down in Orange County, and also ran Butte County up in the Chico area up in Northern California. But, you know, Jack Hare, the father of the hemp movement, he was always insistent on people like John Allegro's work being correct, and he had spent a lot of time studying the citations, and he always recommended that I ignore all of the attacks against Allegro and go through and study it all. So that set me on a path of research that led to discovering that Gordon Wasson was CIA and headed MKUltra Subproject 58, and that led to exposing new aspects of the psychedelic revolution, which are just coming to light now, and the realization that much of the stuff going on behind the psychedelic movement was Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, which, you know, I just interviewed Dr. Rima and General Stubblebine this week on my show discussing Aldous Huxley's work, and Stubblebine admits that Huxley was an agent, but he wouldn't tell me what position. And so, you know, now we're seeing that, you know, their work and trying to expose this idea of the deltas and autism intentionally being created through the use of vaccines, and looking at Aldous Huxley's work, et cetera, it all fits together so damn well. It wouldn't be possible any other way. You know, when I just came across Rima's work a week or two ago, and I had been studying Aldous Huxley's background for at least a couple of years since investigating Wasson and whatnot, and all of the roads and MKUltra and all of this stuff seemed to lead right to Huxley. And so we're getting more and more information lately that he was the key engineer behind a lot of this insanity going on today.
Wow, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to put it, I'm open to anything. I mean, yeah, I'll have to listen to that interview. So I want to know, were you always awake? When did you find out the world was different than the way you were conditioned to believe?
Oh, well, there was, you know, there was a few stages. You know, at first, the first thing I had was when I realized that all of the information on industrial hemp and everything had been suppressed. That kind of woke me up. And then I was awake in a lot of ways, but what happened was in 94, 95, I got into McKenna and went through his work. And so he kind of misled me a little bit down some of these holes that I eventually was able to figure out, and I probably never would have figured them out if I didn't go down his rabbit holes trying to, you know, fool people into his neo-feudalist archaic revival. And so, you know, so then there was the another stage of waking up that a lot of his work was BS, and that started happening around 2004, 2005, when I was writing my first book, and that was, you know, that was really the first time when I sat down and actually started going through all of the citations, you know, and all that sort of thing, and you realize, well, there's an error, well, there's an error, well, that's a problem, you know. And so it was, you know, probably close to a decade ago when I started seeing the problems in it, and then started really piecing it together that guys like, Wasson was an agent. I knew that Wasson was an agent by 2007, but we really couldn't prove it until 2012. And then with McKenna, I kind of knew that he was probably around 2011 or so, but again, you know, we weren't able to really prove it in his own words until this last week. And now everybody's going around trying to say, McKenna was talking about that he was really recruited by the mushrooms, but, you know, if you look at it, like, mushrooms don't have agencies and positions. They don't pay salaries. They don't have public relations departments that he worked in for 15 years, you know, and they don't have, deep background positions either, which obviously intelligence communities have all of those things. But, you know, it's insane that the people will ignore all of his words about his own words about his FBI chase and Interpol being after him, and then he makes a joke about, oh, you mean me being the alien ambassador, and everybody laughs, and he says, well, you know, I was being chased by Interpol and FBI, and I, you know, basically, when he got to La Trera in 1971, I think it was, he gets caught, and he says, and then they offered me a position, and they told me that I had a big mouth, and they had a use for me, you know, and he says, so first I worked in deep background, the less said the better. And then he says, and then they moved me to PR where I worked for the last 15 years. And nobody wants to hear his own words. I mean, they make up all of these magical things to avoid him. No, it was the mushroom. No, the mushroom came down and talked to him. It was like God, and, you know, because they are God, and, you know, and all of this stuff, rather than just looking at his own words.
Hmm.
And then they'll actually say that I'm the crazy one when they're the ones who make up stuff that isn't even written there, and then ignore all of the points that don't fit.
Yeah. So, go back. You said you didn't like school. What didn't you like? Did you like not like the people, the teachers, the academic, the way it was structured, academic structure? What was it about school that you didn't like?
Yes.
Everything. It's interesting because I had a friend, I feel like he's been awake. I've known him since I was about 11, and I feel like he's been awake since he was born. And a lot of the stuff, we were friends and we would hang out, but he would talk about stuff that just went over my head. And now I'm older, I've gone back to him like, oh my God, you were so right. I totally knew what you were talking about. Like, he would do stuff at like 10 or 11, like he wouldn't do the Pledge of Allegiance. And he would like walk out. And he got in trouble, and then he was able to prove that he didn't he didn't have to do it if he didn't want to. The school couldn't do anything about it. So he was, like, excused from doing the Pledge of Allegiance at, like, 11. And I was just like, he's a brilliant guy, yeah. And but now I'm like, oh, dude, you know, I was so
wrong. And I always thought that was crazy when I was a little kid. But then, you know, in my early 20s, I started realizing that all of that was crap. But, you know, you don't until you really get your mind around the trivium, you don't see the extent of a lot of the conditioning and the mind control that we go through, you know, of course, starting with the Pledge of Allegiance in school, and the, you know, the bells in between classes are from Pavlov's dogs.
Yes. I'm a teacher, so I'm starting to see that now, definitely.
Yeah. So, you know, that's where, you know, this is all based on conditioning. It's getting people ready for the workforce where the bell goes off and they're go off to the lunch, and then, okay, we can go to the bathroom at this certain time, and we can have a drink of coffee at this certain time, and, you know, we have to just trudge along, you know, because what happened was when there were skilled workers back in the early 1900s, the skilled workers would butt heads with the factory owners, and they would come to agreements, you know, because both had equal power. So the factory owners wanted to get rid of the skilled laborers and create drones and, you know, just to, and they would try to break down each job as far as possible so that no single person, you know, this was done by this guy Taylor, but so that no single person could have expertise on any one function of the job, per se. You know, and this was all intentionally removed to dumb our society down and get rid of people's expertise in things. I mean, it's just sick, these people's agendas. They're always about disempowering people rather than empowering them. It's always about themselves to everybody else's detriment.
Oh, definitely.
And then they'll turn around and blame us, right, for like the problems created in society from it. Look how stupid they are now. You know, and it's like Edward Bernays will create all of this marketing and everything and get us to be consumers, and then like, look at these consumers, they're polluting the planet, you know, and then it's like then these same group of people PR another idea. Hey, let's come up with carbon credits, so then we'll save them from themselves and from destroying the world. It's wait a second. Wait, you guys were the ones who did all of this stuff all along. So if you are the problem all along, then isn't the solution obvious to everybody?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's very disturbing. Definitely. You know, it's so funny, too. You're talking, going back to, like, school and talk about the conditioning. You're talking about the bells. And then I was talking about the Pledge of Allegiance before that. But I remember one day, like, the way it's done now, you know, they usually have the Pledge of Allegiance done on the yard. So all the schools, all the classes line up like platoons. And you look at it, it kind of looks a little bit like Nazi, you know, like Nazi Germany, because everybody just having
concentration camp.
Yeah. It's great. And I remember one day I opted not to do the Pledge of Allegiance, and I was talking to another teacher.
Don't forget, though, that the U.S. had Japanese concentration camps.
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did.
And then we shouldn't forget that it was the Bolsheviks who killed 40 to 60 million in Russia.
Ugh,
far more than far more than Hitler did.
But oh, no, something really fast, going back to that. Like, I'm talking to the teacher, and then the student, like, turns around. Oh, a couple of students actually turn around, and they were like, you didn't put your hand over your heart. It's like, you know, they're so conditioned into believing that that's what you have to do. If you don't do the Pledge of Allegiance, you're like a bad person, you know.
But you're
something
unpatriotic.
Is wrong with it.
You're not lying to the corporate government who pulls your strings every 4 years from this side or the other of the Hegelian dialectic.
Yeah, it's creepy. As a teacher, I'm easing my way out of education because I just I love to teach, and you know, you can be a teacher without having to be like a teacher in quotes, so to speak. But
well, I mean, you know, Common Core is going to make all education uniform if people don't expose it.
Yeah,
and it's, you know, they want every single student on the exact same level at every single point throughout the world so that they can have all their little mechanized little drone students, and people need to really wake up. And in fact, Clint Richardson just discovered that the U.S. government actually owns the copyrights on all of it. Then they lease it to this India company who then bids it back in, and then they bid on their own copyrights and their own stuff, right? It's all a huge scam.
Jesus.
And then when you get that, you know, it's the antithesis of the trivium, and then they're also trying to implement this crap on homeschoolers and everything else. They want to make every child uniform, and then they're going to try and use force without jurisdiction or legal justification for doing so to force parents into this stuff. You know, but you know, parents, and I've been doing a number of shows with Freeman Burt on all of this, and parents really need to learn how to file counterclaims in court and how to, you know, get out of this mess so that they can't force us to do these sorts of things. All parents and teachers need to be aware of this stuff, you know, and teachers that have the trivium are few and far between. And they're with this core education, they, you know, they're going to have this uniform system of all of the teachers as well. So anyone who is not teaching their exact game plan could actually be outed their group of students is somehow mysteriously way further ahead than some other group of students.
So since you brought up the trivium, can you tell us about the trivium for our audience if they may not know what you're talking about and why it you think it's important for people to understand it and how it works?
Sure. Well, the trivium is an ancient form of education. It means the three roads crossing or meeting. And it's basically, I should say that there are two forms of it. And there's one that is the classical trivium that the elites essentially use to control their management class and to control the lower class as well. But, you know, they may give parts of the upper management class some of it. And then the trivium method is essentially the antithesis of the classical trivium, and the trivium method reveals, in fact, the classical trivium and how it's misused to manipulate us. So the trivium itself, and the trivium is part of the seven liberal arts. There's two components of the seven liberal arts. They're called the trivium and the quadrivium. Now, these are the real seven liberal arts, not the garbage that they teach in universities and colleges today that they call the liberal arts. Now, these seven liberal arts of the trivium and quadrivium are exactly this, and they have to be kept in order, and out of order they're actually used for control. But grammar, logic, rhetoric, and then arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. And when we go through the trivium, the first part, grammar, asks who, what, where, and when, and it's equivalent to knowledge, okay, or like if you wanted to think of it in terms of your computer, it would be input. And then the next phase of the trivium is logic. Logic is the same, would be the same as why, and it is understanding. And it would be, in comparison to your computer, the same as processing. And then rhetoric is how, and it's the last stage of the trivium, and it is wisdom, which is comprised of systematically usable knowledge and understanding from the first two, from grammar and logic, and it is wisdom, and it is the same as output on your computer. So if we took, for instance, processing and tried to put it before input, what would happen? Well, this is essentially what they've done to society through the compulsory education, etc. They've actually tricked people, the society mostly as a whole, into putting grammar before logic. Now, what happens is this destroys the self-esteem, and it gets people to be really distrusting in themselves. They don't trust their own five senses, and this was all done intentionally also by coupling all of this New Age Huxleyan and Hinduism type stuff together, because obviously Hinduism is based on a caste system where, you know, the lower castes are never ever supposed to question the upper caste by religion. That's exactly the same as what Aldous Huxley was selling. So in the trivium, if you take logic and you put it before grammar, what happens is you get people that no longer trust themselves. And then they're always turning to authority to find answers for things. But when you can show them that they can put this stuff back in the right order, put grammar back before logic, then they can suddenly go, oh, well, whenever I approach a new topic, rather than leaping to conclusions, the first thing I need to do is ask who, what, where, and when. So grammar is who, what, where, and when, logic, why, rhetoric, how. So you gather in the information first. You bring in that who, what, where, and when. And so now you have some data that you can work with. You're not trying to process stuff that you channeled from Uranus, right? It's stuff that you've actually gathered. You've checked everything, all of the nouns that are around you in reality that you can verify. And then You bring this knowledge that you've gathered about the items. Like if you look at your desk, you know all of the things sitting on your desk right now in front of you. And so you know what those things are. You know, and if suddenly there was like a black hole there or something, you'd be like, what the hell is that, you know? And so when you know everything that is there, and you know if somebody came along and says, no, there's an elephant on your desk, you can't know the truth of what's on your desk, you know they're lying to you. Okay, so you know all of these things that are sitting there on your desk. Now, the next part of this is logic, going back to logic or the why. And now logic, when we try to understand why, that means we have to begin to process all of the who, what, and where, and when before we can have a why. So why, what? What are you talking about? Who was part of the why? I mean, you have to have something before why before you can have a why. So this is why they like to put logic before grammar, because then people are just left totally befuddled or left to appealing to New Age or, you know, religious stuff that, you know, without any balance in their thinking. So logic is the art of non-contradictory identification. We remove all of the contradictions and all of the logical fallacies in that information, not only in that information as it comes in through our five senses, but most importantly, it is learning to remove the fallacies that we use to deceive ourselves from our own minds. So, you know, like probably 85% of the information in most people's minds is just total BS that they've never verified, that they got from somewhere else. They never spent a couple of minutes to verify it. Now, a lot of people say, well, it takes too long to do research and to verify, and I don't know how to do that. Well, you know, if you spend a few minutes usually, and it's just really, you know, checking one citation after the other and following the line and making sure that people's statements are true and not based on ad hominem attacks or appeals to emotion or fancy thinking and whatnot, and you can actually verify that these points are true, then you know that it's a truth. And so, you know, this is all key in understanding the world around you, and it's also key and how you're confused. But when you look outside in the world around you, you can see, oh, well, there's a wall, or there's a window, there's a house, there's a street, there's a telephone pole, there's a plant, there's all of these different things there. And these are nouns. And, you know, so when we get that all of these things out there in front of us, there are nouns, or they're essentially words that we can see that are living and doing whatever they do out there, then we can also see that none of these nouns are existing on top of each other or inside of each other, so to speak, at the same time. I mean, in other words, there are no contradictions in nature. We don't see, you know, birds flying through a wall or something like that. You know what I mean? So all of these nouns exist on their own, and they have a right to exist on their own, just like you exist on your own. So then when we realize that there are no contradictions in nature, we can see that the only contradictions then are the contradictions in our own minds. And why are there contradictions? And a lot of people will think that, okay, well, you know, you can't know anything because of these contradictions and because they've been fooled not to check things. You know, this, like guys like a Mick Goswami selling this, you know, quantum physics nonsense. But the idea is to get you to not trust yourself. And in quantum physics, they actually argue that you can have 11 or 12 contradictions in nature at the same time. But we see that there are no contradictions in nature. So what all of these quantum physicists are actually arguing over the contradictions in their own minds. So
yeah,
but you know, just to continue explaining the trivium here for a second, the trivium removes these contradictions and removes the deceptions and makes sure that, you know, the premise that we're working from is correct before we go build the next step. The issue, like with quantum physics, is they start with a lot of false premises that they didn't first verify, and then they go run off to look for magical conclusions, you know, regarding these things. And so, you know, it's, you know, then they look for all of these mystical answers. Well, the word mystic, or to mystify, means to befuddle or confuse. The word sacred comes from secret, etc. The word occult is hidden. And, you know, so all of these words that they use, you know, as esoteric would be hidden, whereas exoteric is out to the public. But, you know, all of these words suggest, you know, things that are hidden and being used against people. So when we use the logical fallacies and we have knowledge of them, we can see through these tricks, we can realize the onus of proof. We can just go down and check a citation and go, you know, that wasn't true, and I'm not going to get caught up in your appeals to emotion, or I'm not going to believe that the research is wrong just because you called that person a bad name. And, you know, that's most people's logic today, is they'll just dismiss something because somebody else said a bad name and they never verified it. But so when we realize that it is actually easier to spend a few minutes or a few hours or maybe even a few days or weeks to verify something than it is to spend a whole lifetime believing a lie, then we can understand the importance of it. You know, so people actually, a lot of people will actually believe that it's more complicated to spend a little bit of time doing research about their beliefs than it is to just go ahead and believe them whether they're true or false. So most people end up with a lot of garbage in their minds. And so, you know, all of this has been done intentionally. So anyway, we remove these contradictions with logic. We remove the fallacy. So now we have a clear understanding of the knowledge that we had. We have clear understanding or why of the grammar. Okay, so then when we go to output, the how, now we're basically able to explain that wisdom onto others through the removing of the contradictions and the fallacies. You know, the wisdom part or the rhetoric expressing that to others is systematically usable knowledge and understanding. And so also when this process is used, if somebody brings in new information, then we have a systematic way to go back through and verify that new information and compare it to what we've already done and see if it fits or if it's thrown out. And so it basically cuts your study time of any subject down in half, because rather than getting caught up in all of the fallacies and errors and things trying to learn something, you actually can just cut right through all of that. And so, you know, it quickens our thinking time, et cetera. So anyway, to finish up here, I know this was really long. Thanks for being so patient.
No, you're very informative.
So
the next part is the quadrivium. And now the quadrivium is arithmetic, which is number in itself, geometry, which is number in time, or excuse me, geometry, number in space, music is number in time, and then astronomy is number in space and time. So again, if you want to mess up a whole bunch of children, let's say 7th and 8th graders, who are, you know, they go from elementary and they're getting into junior high and stuff, starting to study algebra. Well, so what was algebra based on here? Let's see, we went arithmetic, then we went geometry, then we went into music. So we went arithmetic, and then in the schools they go from arithmetic straight into algebra. Now kids walk out of school going, I don't know why I would ever need this. I'm totally confused. They come out just completely, you know, they get really frustrated with algebra because algebra comes from geometry. Now if you were teaching a child geometry first, then they could walk outside, they could look at a pine cone or a flower, they could see the Fibonacci or the golden ratio, they could look at the ratios of a building, et cetera, and how it's built, and they would immediately see in nature how this math directly applies to everything around them. No kid would ever walk out of one of these math classes going, now, what the hell would I ever use this for? They would just look around them and they would see it everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's key to destroy the child's mind that they put algebra before geometry. And, you know, so then you get, then you have good Target and Walmart cashier workers who are totally confused with how about life and eating their wheat and drinking their fluoridated water and their low fat diet milk and stuff, making themselves sicker every day. And then we can see where the progression of all of this is going. But all of these things need to be in order to work properly. And so, you know, not only do they corrupt them and take them out of order, but, you know, they use the fallacies and things within that to manipulate us as well. So anyway, I'll pass it back over to you.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about algebra. It reminded me of something Temple Grandin said, a famous autistic woman who they made a movie about her, and she said that when she was in school, they tried to teach her algebra, and she almost lost her mind. So she had a teacher that had the foresight to say, well, I'm going to teach you geometry. And then it all came together. And then she understood, and that's how she was then able to go on to build these
things that she built. To
sure.
She literally said she almost lost her mind. I feel like I lost mine too.
She lost her mind because it didn't make sense. You know,
sure.
She had a very logical mind, being an autistic person, that was too abstract. She couldn't understand it until there was something concrete that made sense.
In my own case, as a kid, math was my favorite subject until I got into junior high and they threw me into algebra, and then it totally scrambled me. And then what they did was they double punished me because I didn't get algebra in seventh grade. Then they threw me into summer school, and then I had to take it twice.
Oh, no,
that's exactly
terrible.
What happened to me.
So, you know, it was double the frustration, although in summer school I got it, you know, better or more clearly. But, you know, the whole problem in the first place was befuddling my, you know, all of our minds by teaching us algebra out of order. I mean, you know, once you get that algebra comes from geometry, then it's like, oh, well, of course you need geometry. And then you can just walk outside and you can pick something up and you can show a child how it applies. It's
yeah.
just so simple, you know, but...
Yeah. You walk out, like, I just remember taking math and being like, I'm never going to use this. I'm like, I'm going to use addition. I'm going to use maybe fractions if I'm baking. But
sure.
other than that, like, it was just, I didn't know why I was being put through this fucking torture. Because
right.
that's what it was.
And then
you
when
know?
You get that algebra is based on geometry, you just walk outside and it's like, oh, look, you have the golden ratio. You have all of these different formulas that you can use out of geometry. And then now you can measure them with algebra out in the real world, right? And so then all of a sudden you can start seeing all of these things out in the real world. And you go, oh, of course, it's all a math
yeah.
out there. Now
yeah.
I see it,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
But that's
not
part of the trick. It's the same. It's just as bad as putting logic before grammar, putting algebra before geometry. It just totally messes up the kid's head.
Yeah, definitely. And then going back to the autism thing, I saw that you had an interview with Dr. Andrew Wakefield. I mean, would you say sort of how his situation was played out in the media would be a good example of how the distortion of the teaching of the trivium?
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
gets tricked people.
Totally. I mean, if people had the trivium, there would be no way those tricks would work. You know, people would be like, what? Why are they name calling at him? Let me go check those citations, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, as soon as you go pick up Wakefield's book and read it, you realize that the whole thing against him is a scam. He and his lawyer wrote this book detailing all of the court hearings, all of the letters and everything are right there. I mean, you can read, you know, everything. You can see that Richard Horton from The Lancet lied and covered this whole thing up. You can see that John Deerfield, or whatever his name was paid by Fox News and Rupert Murdoch and Rupert Murdoch's son and all of this stuff. And then you connect it with, you know, Bill Gates talking about reducing 10% of the population with vaccines. And then you connect it with Dr. Rima's information from Christina England on autism being intentional, and then you get into all of Aldous Huxley's disgusting stuff from Brave New World, and you go, wow, you know, they are actually putting all of these autism people to work out in the field, and they're starting to pop up everywhere, and they're creating huge, you know, a workforce of teachers
yeah.
that are dedicated just teaching students with autism, so they're gearing up to implement this new Delta and Epsilon level of society on us that they've created by poisoning us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's occurred to me many times, because I actually have an autistic child, and he regressed after the MMR vaccine. So, and I, after the whole Wakefield cullification, and people were, I mean, it was just outright lies. They were saying things that just weren't even absolutely untrue, that he was creating his own vaccine and all that, which wasn't true.
Oh, yeah, I mean, everything they said about him was completely made up. I mean, none of the claims against him were correct.
But but people would say to me that I didn't know what happened, and I'm going, they're trying to say that I didn't experience my own experience. I'm going, but wait a second, I saw this in my own home.
And that's what they always want to do, you know. And the doctors are conditioned that it's totally crazy, and the doctors don't have critical thinking either. But, you know, it's like you don't know your own child. And wait, let's see, he was fine. Then yesterday I went to doctor. Then today he's having all these problems, but, you know, they want you to be, oh, no, the vaccine didn't have anything to do with it. You just injected poison into your child's body, and it had nothing to do with it. I mean, you know, it's just insanity. And none of these vaccines have been tested for safety, you know. And when I was a kid, they didn't give you your vaccines until you were over the age of two, you know. And now they try and do this crap the minute you're born.
Yep.
And, you know, when my son was born, they actually tried to have social services come in on us because we refused to let them vaccinate.
Yeah, that happens all the time. And that's the whole reason we shouldn't even be having our children in hospitals, because they'll try and, you know, take them away from you if you don't want to do
the
vaccine.
You know, they'll try and tell you that if you don't sign the Social Security card and give up your ownership of your child to the government, and if you don't get these vaccines, then they won't let you leave. But people need to realize that they cannot hold you and your baby hostage, period. That would be kidnap and hostage taking,
right?
Period. And so people actually are fearful because of these tactics that hospitals use, you know. And hospitals will intentionally try to put mothers on baby formula. One of the biggest things that hospitals do is put the mother on a schedule. And then, so natural birth mothers are pushed aside intentionally, and then they put all of this extra pressure to try and push cesarean, because the second they do a cut, not only can they keep to their schedule, but they just made thousands of dollars more. And and then they can keep you in the hospital. And not only that, but as the second you do a cesarean, then you're not supposed to hold your baby for a week or two, and you're supposed to be able to breastfeed. So then guess what? Now they just got your baby hooked up on this soy formula. Now, soy is huge in estrogen. If you give it to a baby boy, you've just destroyed him.
Yeah, not to mention, I think I read that most of these baby formulas are about 60-70% corn syrup.
Ugh.
Yeah. Oh, what?
So that's also contaminated with mercury. They found that corn syrup's contaminated with mercury.
Oh, that's terrible.
Gross.
You know, and it's just, you know, their way of poisoning the kids and these, you know, these elites and these oligarchs and whatnot with their eugenics programs. They think they're all cool. You know, and another big thing of the eugenics program is getting people to eat wheat. Wheat is, you know, the single most poisonous thing out there that you can possibly put in your body, any form of it. And, 80 to 90% of the population has, immediate drastic side effects from it. And side effects include obesity, schizophrenia, acne, psoriasis, eczema,
asthma,
IBS, and any number of other things. And they keep telling people to eat the whole grains and eat the wheat and all of this stuff. And then, almost all heart disease is related to wheat. They've sold the big lie that it's meat and saturated fats and bacon and eggs that causes it. It's not at all, especially not the wholesome grass-fed stuff. You know, maybe they're factory lot garbage. But all of these things, you know, that they've sold, you know, they've basically turned everything upside down. Like the bad cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol, comes from grains. It has nothing to do with animal products. And then your brain is 77%+ hydroxycholesterol, and it requires saturated fats and cholesterol to live, or the good HDL cholesterol. So then if they have you on a low-fat diet taking Lipitor with high wheat that inflames the entire body, you're going to be sick, you're going to be obese, you're going to have tooth decay, you're going to have mental problems, you're going to have all of these different things. And then what they'll do is they will sell you drugs rather than just saying, you know what, you need to put 3 ounces of butter in your coffee every morning, no sugar, and you need to stop eating wheat. Oh, and by the way, why don't you toss a tablespoon of salt and a cup of water in the morning when you get up, and that'll clear up a lot of these other problems, too.
Did you say three butter in your coffee?
Yep.
Were you being sarcastic, or were you, like...
No, not at all.
So what does the butter do? Because I'm thinking butter isn't, my understanding is butter isn't that good for you.
It's organic and grass-fed, though, right?
Well, I mean, you're not getting mycotoxin-filled factory lot butter. I mean, what do you mean it's not good for you? Who told you it wasn't good for you? I mean, see...
I'm thinking about dairy. I'm thinking about...
Dairy
issues. I can't really do... But go on.
Well, what kind of dairy are you eating?
I just don't eat it anymore.
Are you eating pasteurized dairy?
Probably. probably. Well, I mean, I haven't had dairy in years, though. I just
because
products now, though.
When you pasteurize milk, it destroys the lactate in the milk, which then makes you lactose intolerant. So then they sell you a drug so that you're no longer lactose intolerant. So the solution is just don't consume, you know, factory produced dairy. You get raw milk, you get raw cheese, raw butter. You get
but they'll put me in jail if I do that. I'm just joking. I said they'll put me in jail, or they'll seize the people that, you know,
we just have to have way more of us than they can ever handle, you know. But yeah, you know, you look up David Asprey. I've done a couple of interviews with him on my show. He's the one who created the idea of bulletproof coffee.
Yes, I just actually saw the interview a couple of days ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's the one with putting the 3 ounces of butter in your coffee. And then what happens is you'll have about 5 or 6 hours of pure solid energy. There's no come down. You don't have cravings for food all day. And you know, what people don't realize, you know, they sit there at their desks at work with snacks and crackers and pretzels and all this stuff. Well, wheat works on the oat. Not only does it totally destroy your health, but it acts on the opium receptor sites of the brain. So it's addictive.
Like heroin.
Like heroin. Yeah. So when you stop eating it, you actually, you know, after about 7 to 10 days, you'll actually notice a fog clear off your brain.
It's true. It relieves the brain fog once you stop. And my son, before we went off wheat and he would eat it, his pupils would get dilated like he was on acid or something. For real. And he's autistic, so he would do a lot of self-stimulatory kind of things. It would sort of spike up, and if he has an infraction still, I can see right away because he gets like that. It's creepy.
You want to try putting him on a fat, you know, a high-fat diet too. Does he ever sneak in the kitchen and, like, steal butter and stuff?
He eats a lot. I give him a ghee because he does have a pretty big dairy allergy. But I do a lot of fat, though.
No, but don't ever give him pasteurized dairy. Make sure.
No.
Only raw milk and stuff. You know, most of those allergies are only because it's pasteurized.
Right. Yes. And we do buy raw milk and raw butter, but he still doesn't seem to tolerate the raw milk. So my other son drinks the raw milk, and he can have, I usually give him the grass-fed ghee, and I give him a lot of that, a lot of coconut oil, a lot of fat in his diet. I know that's what.
Cool. Yeah, you know, you're going to have to just keep pushing the high-fat diet probably for a long time.
Yes, definitely. And he does go in for that, and he craves that, and so do I. I actually do, too. We have raw butter in the house, and I just like, oh, it's expensive, but I will eat it really quickly.
We usually keep about 20 to 40 pounds of butter around the house at all times.
It's so good.
Yeah. And then, you know, if you put 3 ounces in your coffee in the morning, and, you know, that's times two, that's almost a full bar, you know. And I, you know, for a while we were just splitting a full bar for 2 cups, you know, and I was getting a lot of energy out of that. But we've tapered it back a little bit in the last month, going to 3 ounces per cup. But, I mean, yeah, it just makes you feel so much better. Your head is clear. Your skin feels good. You're not hungry all the time. You have energy to get things done like you would not believe.
True story.
Good. So do you think you could explain more on the role that vaccines play in mind control and the Delta worker?
Well, Dr. Rima would certainly be better than me at that. I mean, it was her friend, Christina England, who discovered that, informed her, and then she had done some interviews with a friend of mine, Clint, who then told me. But, you know, but I've been working with her for the last week. Obviously, I just did a show with her and General Stubblebine this week regarding all of this stuff. But, you know, essentially what we're looking at is MKUltra was based on Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. It appears, and Stubblebine admitted that Huxley was an agent. I've still not been able to get the exact position. A number of other people have said that he was an agent. Livingstone has a new book out called Black Terror, White Soldiers that also shows that Huxley was CIA, etc., basically engineering this whole design plan for society. And then what he would do is he would go out and he would warn people that somebody out there was doing it, but he never warned anybody that it was he and his brother who were designing most of it. And his brother was the head of the British Eugenics Society. And so basically,
right. Like that interview with Mike Wallace.
Exactly. You know, yeah. he never says, you know, hey, you guys, we are doing this. He says, somebody out there, you know, and then you find out he's a Fabian socialist with a wolf in sheep's clothing. And then you find out that he's hanging out with guys like General Eisenhower at the Century Club. But, you know, General Eisenhower is the same guy who went on TV warning everybody about the military-industrial complex, but never says, I'm the one doing it. It's me and my friends. You know, so, I mean, it's like the same pattern, right?
Right.
You know, it's like here you have these guys hanging out with each other, and then they're doing the same stuff, supposedly warning the public, but never saying that it's actually them and it's their scandal doing it. So,
exactly.
Right. And then, you know, Huxley's book, you know, they have the Soma. The Soma comes from the ancient Rig Vedas in India, and essentially, you know, and I it took me years of going through the whole field of psychedelic studies and ethnomycology to figure this out, but in ancient India they used the Soma to control the masses. And,
right.
And you know, that they would give the people the drugs so that they wouldn't question. And then you read, like, Piero Comparesi's book, The Bread of Dreams, and he shows throughout the Middle Ages in Italy, et cetera, that the elites would often drug the masses and stuff, and it would cause total disarray, and it would, you know, keep the religious feelings flowing and this sort of thing, but they would basically use it for control. And you look, you know, there's just all of these instances where they've used drugging the masses for control and then basically selling them a religion and while they're drugged on top of it. And then they say, okay, well, yeah, I was drugged and I had this experience, so it must be spiritual when it could be just a biological reaction. Or it may be spiritual. We, you know, I don't claim to understand God or the human mind, but, you know, the interesting thing is the quadrivium shows that something is there and it's not in, you know, in any of this other stuff that we see out there.
Right. I'm curious, do you think that intelligence is required to become conscious of the inner workings of the world or to become awake? Or do you think is it something else that that people
need to
possess?
Well, let me ask you this. If you are conscious of something, are you aware of it? And if you are unconscious of something, are you unaware of it?
If I'm conscious of something, am I aware of it? And if I'm, would you say that again? I'm
right.
Sorry.
And if you're not conscious of something, are you unaware of it? Obviously, to be conscious of something, you have to be aware, right? So, and to be unconscious would be to be unaware, you know. So you can't be unconscious and aware, essentially, you know. So you might be aware of one single item, for instance, like, you know, this microphone in front of me. I'm aware that it's here. If I was unconscious, I wouldn't be aware of it here.
Got you. Well, I guess, let me guess what I'm trying to say. I think that, you know, there's certain people that are awake and they're open to the fact that there are entities or there is an elite that rule the world. And then...
Okay, let me back you up for a second. Yeah. When you say entities, what do you mean by that? We have to define our words so that we can speak each other.
People or beings, I'm open to the fact that they maybe aren't human, or they are human, I don't know.
Okay, so let me ask you this. When you throw out the word that they maybe aren't human, what evidence do you have of that?
It's just evidence.
Evidence. You know, that you and I can...
It's more of an
put out in the comments, and that Sarah and April and I can all look at and verify with you.
Well, it's you know, it's an intuition that just a lot of the stuff that they're, you know, I believe that humans are fundamentally good, and any time that we are, you know, evil toward each other, it's because we've been manipulated to do so. And I think on the scale that...
But there are, I mean, when you say that humans are good, that would be a sweeping generalization about all humans without considering individual personalities and obvious references to some people that aren't good.
Well, I'm basing off my experiences with my life with humans.
But let me just point out the next phase is that, and then what you're doing, though, is rather than accepting that some people are inherently bad or were mistreated and have psychological problems or were conditioned via their religion or whatever as a child to commit these things against others, instead of looking at these possibilities, then what you're doing is you're automatically looking for a magical outside source that might cause that influence.
Well, I think that, you know, it's possible. I'm open to that as well, but I'm also open
sure,
to the point that they aren't. So what
sure,
what evidence
I mean,
do you have that this says that they aren't?
Hold on. What I'm getting at, here's the issue, when we're looking at something from the trivium, we have to understand two points. One, what is the onus of proof? And two, what is arguing the arbitrary? Okay. So the onus of proof means that anybody who makes a claim of anything, it's entirely on them to support it. This is why in court we're supposed to, quote unquote, have innocence until proven guilty, because you cannot prove a negative. So anybody who makes a claim, it's always on them to support it. So I could say that I have a green fairy sitting right here in the corner next to me, and I'll sell it to you for $120. And if you say, well, I don't see it, you know, I don't turn around and say, you effing bitch, what do you mean? You know, it's totally on me to provide the proof that that fairy exists. And if I don't, then you dismiss it. Now, if I continue without proof to try and argue that the fairy is there without evidence, then this is known as arguing the arbitrary, and the argument is automatically dismissed. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't put a question mark on the argument and throw it on the back of your in the back of your mind somewhere in the, you know, archive maybe closet to do not pull out again until evidence is found, you know, place where you have there. But you leave it there and you never send it downstream until you have that bit of evidence, because then what happens is if you don't have evidence, then it just becomes speculating, it becomes a mental virus. And then what happens is it goes out and it's, you know, and it infects other people's time and mental space. And if it's not verified information, then it becomes an actual mental virus where it can be used to control them or manipulate them.
Well, but at the same time, it's like you don't have any. Do you have any proof that they are human? You're also just guessing.
See, it's not on me.
Because you're not.
Yeah. See, I can look at.
No, but goes on behind.
Hold on a second. See, when I see a dog, I know what a dog is. When I see a person, I know what a person is. It's not on me to prove that they're not humans. Okay, if you're the one who is arguing that they are not humans, it is on you, again, to prove that. That is what the onus of proof is. That is your argument.
I get that, but I'm saying I'm open to the possibility that they aren't humans. That there are humans as far
what
as
I'm saying
human,
is,
but if they're not human, I wouldn't be surprised.
But what I'm saying, though, is that what evidence do you have? If you don't have evidence that they aren't human, then you can say, well, you know, it might be possible. But you can have a lot of might be possibles out there in the quantum physics Roger Rabbit world. It doesn't mean it's real.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean it's not real either.
But you are the one making the argument, so then it falls totally 100% on you to support it, no one else.
Well, I'm not. I guess
if you're the one arguing that they might be something else other than human, then it is fully on you to support it. And if you have no evidence to support it, then you totally do not send it downstream. It might be a hypothetical maybe. Like I said, you throw it in the back of your mind in that dark closet with a question mark on it, and you leave it there until you have evidence.
Does that, well, I mean, it's a belief. It's an intuition that I think that could be
okay,
possible. I've never seen a reptilian. I subscribe to the fact that we are, you know, we live on Earth, and then I believe you subscribe to the fact that we live on Earth, and there's a galaxy out there with you know, other planets, that it's
okay.
possible that there are other
sure.
beings that could come down.
Sure.
And why would they come down in space?
What evidence?
Okay.
You have the person X, Y, or Z is an alien. If you have no evidence, I mean, you're here, you're building this huge thing of possibilities out there, and you can just go on forever with all of these possibilities, but with no evidence. Do you see where I'm getting here?
Yeah, I get what you're saying, but I also don't think that there's anything necessarily wrong with that, because we have to realize that we don't know.
What the issue is all of these UFO speculations and all of this New Age stuff is what they use to fool people, and if you get caught in that stuff without evidence, that is what tricks you. Oh, it sounds spiritual and groovy and it's cool. You know, and it's possible and maybe, but if you have no evidence, there is no onus of proof, and it's arguing the arbitrary, and it's tossed.
What about people that have had, you know, like, or claim to have had been abducted by UFOs? No, they can't prove it. It's really on you to just kind of take their word over.
So anybody who makes up that they're a mystic or a guru or speaks to God or, you know, talks to aliens, you should believe it?
I will be open to the possibility of it. I don't believe just anything, but I just also...
Here's my point. You can be open to the possibility, okay, but they have to supply that evidence. If they don't supply the evidence, you toss it, okay? You're not saying that, hey, you know, you're completely full of shit and I'm going to kill the messenger. You're saying, give me your evidence. We'll sit down and we'll look at it, and then we'll decide the facts of the matter. Oh, you don't have any evidence. Oh, well, that's a problem. Then we have to throw the idea out completely.
But you know what? Also, I think, you know, because we are both left brain and right brain, you know, in today's society, that kind of goes more onto the intuitive and sensitive side of the human being. And I think...
Here's the thing is you want to appeal to all of this emotion and good feeling stuff, but we have to have a balance. We have to be able to go out and verify things that we say. Now, okay, well, I'm going to... think that this person is a lizard because, you know, David Icke told me so.
Well, I think, okay, but I think that if you're just relying solely on logic, then that isn't a balance.
Solely on logic. In fact, the first thing that engages you when you get caught into these fallacies is the intuition. The intuition kicks on, up, this person just lied to me. What do you mean that, you know, these people are half lizards? Okay, do you have any evidence of that? Then the five senses kick on and they say, okay, I'm willing to entertain that idea. Give me some evidence. And then no evidence comes and you can say, okay, well, this is BS, you know, because otherwise people can make up whatever dreamy BS that sounds cool to fool you. You have to realize that anybody who makes the claim, the onus is on them. If they say someone is the alien, it is on them always to support that claim. Period. It's not on anybody else to disprove it, to try and prove the negative. If they don't come up with the evidence themselves, it is always on them. The failure is on them. And if you dismiss it, it's on them. And, you know, the issue is, though, if you have not verified information, you're just sending stuff downstream that you channeled from your anus without verifying it, then they become mental viruses and they infect people. So this is why it is... you know, why the trivium is so important and why they have taken the trivium from us is also so that they can sell us all of these exact same ideas without having the sort of self-confidence to go out and check them and make sure that our ideas are correct.
What do you think about Bohemian Grove and the fact that they've been caught up, like having ceremony, or there have been certain members of society elite that have been caught, you know, worshiping and doing ceremonies like that? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, they're part of the West Coast sister club of the Century Club that Gordon Wasson and Aldous Huxley and all those guys hung out with. Alexander Shulgin is a Owl Club member, as are the Grateful Dead, etc. This is a group of people that, you know, they have their little ritual magic and things that they use. You know, magic, again, you know, magi, the word, you know, abracadabra is from Abecedarian, for instance, A-B-C-D. It's your A-B-C. So it's somebody who casts a spell using magic. They're using letters and words. And this is what sophism is. It's using magic to fool others. And that's why, like, your legal magistrate, the first part of that word is magi. He writes some words down, bangs a gavel, and he's just created magic. But, you know, all of these people are, you know, I could care less about their rituals and everything. What they're doing is taking the sophism out into the real world and using that. You know, all of their stuff, all of the rituals that they use is just to fool each other and the public. You know, it's just like a judge puts on a big gown and he walks up three stairs and then he looks like this authority that you want to believe in. It's, you know, this false appeal to authority. It's all about the show.
Well, they do this stuff, though, in secret, though. They're not, like, having...
It's irrelevant.
Why is it irrelevant?
It's irrelevant.
They obviously have some connection to it if they're doing...
The point is, well, you know, it's a lot of, you know, plays and things that they do. You know, you can go to libraries and look at the annual plays the pageants and stuff that they put on every year. I mean, it's basically...
Well, it's irrelevant because you don't
understand it. It's basically a meeting of rich men who get together, who... you know, I have a lot of shits and giggles and who do plot their economic things against the masses. You know, the rituals, you know, the ritual is used as a method of control. Okay.
Yeah.
When somebody, you know, if it's basically like peacocking. If you look at media stars and all of these TV idols and shit, all you have to do is put a dress on them and put some lights on them and some fancy stuff, make them appear to be an alpha, and everybody chases after that. Rituals, you know, like I just said, the judge bangs a gavel, that's a ritual. There are lots and lots of rituals that are used in society. The ritual is a show for instilling the control in the others.
Okay. But you're saying it's irrelevant. Do you feel it's irrelevant because you don't understand it? If you understand it...
No, what I'm getting at is when you understand the fallacies and things, you can focus on the individual things without getting caught up in, well, they do rituals, so magic must be real.
Well, it's real to them. I think they believe it.
Rituals are real to them. And they are using sophism that they use to, you know, to mind control people that they use through these rituals, just like the Masons do. You know, these...
Well, isn't that a form of magic, though?
They're structured pyramidically so that at the top, one guy has control and can see the whole thing. Everybody below him has less information. Okay, just because you believe in the rituals at the bottom of the Masons doesn't mean that the guy at the top does.
I get that.
There to keep everybody below the top guy in line.
Like the Wizard of Oz, basically.
That's what I'm saying. It's like peacocking. It's just, you know, it's about the alpha.
Joining a fraternity or something.
Make them look authoritative and like they have the right to do this stuff because they performed a little ritual.
Right. Got you. So
that is based on words and spelling. You know, that's why I said the word abracadabra comes from the word abecedarian. It's the ABCs. That's why we have, you know, magic is spelling. You know, it's because it's abracadabra, abecedarian, the ABCDs. It's based on the words and language that are used, and that is exactly what the sophists do. That is what the magi does. He uses sophism and word tricks to get people to believe him. You might think that, yeah, you know, we're going to pop into the next dimension because of this ritual or whatever, but he's using it simply to befuddle you.
Got you. So, just going back before we went on a tangent, I'm just going to say I think that it is a possibility that these people, some of them aren't human. I don't have the evidence. I can't say it with a conviction because I've never seen a reptilian.
I would
never
send that downstream, though. I mean,
I think that it's a possibility.
But you never, you know, see here.
But why? It seems like you have a problem that. I mean, do you have a problem with them? The possibility that they aren't human.
What I have a problem with is you constantly presenting ideas with zero evidence to support them. I mean, you can pull stuff out of your butt all day long and sell it as real, but if you don't have any evidence, what's the point in it?
I'm not selling it as real. I just think that it's a possibility.
Okay,
I'm open
you
to the
always
possibility.
Put it out. Then whenever you tell it to anybody else, you should always say, I have zero evidence for this claim whatsoever. I just think it's a neat idea, and here it is. And you never put it out any further than that.
I don't think it's a neat idea. I think it's a possibility, and I don't have to, you know, I can say...
You have evidence. I mean... It's possible
so you have possibilities
that planet Mars. Do you agree that it's possible that we'll wake up on Mars tomorrow morning?
Yeah. Why not? it's maybe not probable, but I mean.
Well,
unless we
have spaceships sitting outside, it's not going to be possible either. I mean, unless you have a way to get there, this isn't a quantum world.
Well,
Do
you subscribe to the fact that there are other races out there that we live on Earth and there are other galaxies out there?
I subscribe that there may be, but I don't send that downstream and go sell alien posters until I have evidence that, you know, until I have an alien sitting here I can verify or something, you know?
That's the thing that I'm saying, too. I'm saying that it's a possibility, that there's a maybe. I wouldn't be surprised. I'm open to that.
You don't get caught into it. You don't, you know, make it part of your religion. You don't.
No, I don't.
It. You just put it out there and you say, well, this could be possible, but if you don't have any evidence of it, you never put it any further. And you know, and when you're into a logical conversation with somebody, if you don't have evidence of something, you simply don't present it because it's just arguing the arbitrary. It's just nonsense.
Okay.
It's just noise. You know, and the issue is we can bring up anything and everything. You know, in quantum physics, they want you to think that all you have to do is twinkle your nose and tip your toes, and you're going to, you know, flash off into the next universe. But this isn't Bewitched. You know, we have to use a little bit of critical thinking. And, you know, if somebody throws a rock at you and you see the rock coming, you're going to dodge it, because you know otherwise it's going to hit you and it's going to hurt like hell. So, you know, the reality does exist. There are no contradictions in nature. You're not going to, you know, just magically pass through walls.
Do you think that intelligence and logic is more important than intuition and sensitivity?
Well, I just said that the first part that engages logic would be intuition. You know, so since intuition is the first part, like when somebody lies to you, it's intuition that goes, that wasn't right. And then the logic aspect is engaged by intuition, and then the logic aspect runs through and it says, oh, this person just used this lie on me specifically. Now, do we need to sugarcoat things for people or whatever, or constantly appeal to their emotions because they've been trained or conditioned to only think, you know, with their emotions? I mean, that's left up to the individual. Personally, I don't like to sugarcoat things. I mean, you know, it might not be as soft and as cozy and as warm and fuzzy, but it gets the point through nonetheless. I mean, people might be, you know, resistive to it, but the issue is that it gets in and it will sit there and it will process, and eventually they will realize it.
But this, if I'm right, what you're saying about intuition and logic, it's like you're still using logic to prove that the intuition is valid. And my understanding of intuition is just something that you feel and you know, and it's something that you can't use logic to prove.
That's because you have a misconception of intuition and logic.
Well, okay.
See, logic, you think, you see logic as something like what was portrayed on Star Trek with Spock. And, you know, logic is all bad and it's corrupt and it's cold and it's mean and it's all of these dark things, and we have to dismiss anything from Western philosophy. All of that stuff is bad, but, you know, this is all dismissing it. And what's happening is you're assuming what logic is without putting the information in there first. What you're doing is you're putting your logic before your grammar, and then you're assuming that logic is a certain way without understanding it. See, when information comes in, you have a feeling. Okay, I have this feeling. I have this implicit feeling that I was just lied to from my intuition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what was the lie? Oh, I don't know. Well, then that would require logic to figure that out, wouldn't it? So the intuition is just engage the mind to say, I was lied to. I got a funny feeling from that. Now, what was the lie? I don't know. So how do you get that implicit feeling over to explicit? So when you memorize the logical fallacies and the trivium, then it goes over to the other side of the brain, and it will process through the logical fallacies until it finds the one that's the closest match. And after about 2 years, this happens instantaneously, and you can say, oh, this person just used this specific lie on me, and then you're able to defend yourself from it.
Gotcha.
But they both work together. I mean, you're trying to work, you know, it's sort of a, you know, and I covered this in my interview with Mark Passio last week. If you're working in sort of a very off-balanced sort of way where you're trying to only engage the feminine without engaging the masculine at all.
Gotcha. And I don't think logic is bad. I think they're equal. Intuition and logic are equally as important. But what I'm going to do, I'm going to leave that boat in the stream, and then I'm going to see if I can find some evidence for you. I'm going to send an alien to your house.
Yeah, please.
So, you know, we call ourselves the reptilian slayers every now and then.
But I understand your point.
Hold on. When you get the onus of proof, and when you get what arguing the arbitrary is, you'll understand half the bullshit and mind control out there. And then you can just go, oh, damn, I got it. Okay. You know, but if you keep trying to hold on to all of these ideas, you know, oh, I don't want to be, I wasn't duped. I've got to hold on to this. There's no, I'm too smart to get duped. You know, you just have to realize that until you process everything in your mind through the trivium, that probably 85% of what's in there was BS that duped you. And then you just get to a point where you go, that was good, and you laugh it off. You know, because if you get defensive about it, then they're going to keep you in their control. But if you can just laugh it off, just be like, you fuckers, you got me.
Yeah.
You know, then you can just let it go and you can move on. You know, see, the idea is, you know, when you pick up a glass of water, and I have this glass of water here. you know, you can look at the glass, you can tap the glass, you can smell the glass, and, you know, you can hear the glass and do all of this stuff, but, you know, at the end of that, you can set it down. You don't have to make the glass a part of your religion. You can pick up any idea, whether it's aliens or UFOs or whatever, and you can look at the idea, you can see what's there to support it, you can see how founded it is in reality, and if you can go out and verify anything about it, and then you can just set it down. It doesn't ever have to become a part of you where you have to feel like you need to be defensive or whatever about it. These are just things that you, you know, look at and you remain detached from, you know, and then when you need to be emotional regarding your family and your lovers and things like that, then, you know, that's where that stuff works well. But, you know, if you're, you know, getting emotional over, you know, the possibility of something happening in another lifetime or in another galaxy, then, I mean, then it's like, you know, what for? What purpose does it serve in the here and now?
Okay. Yeah.
Would you say that in like our movement, and some people call it the truth movement or what have you, that there is a lot of this sort of beliefs based in religion, or like the religion of trutherism kind of thing?
I mean, it's, you know, it's what you have, and it's a total irony at face value, because you have all of these people that call themselves the truth movement, and they're often caught in logical fallacies or going after the wrong target. You know, it's like the Occupy Wall Street movement. When you get into Clint Richardson's work, you realize that through the CAFR, the Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports, that it's the cities, counties, states, and federal government doing it, and that you should be actually protesting your local city hall running all of this stuff. Then you realize that, you know, protesting down at Wall Street is a total distraction. And then, you know, not only are you not being effective, but then if you're on the wrong target, how could it be the truth, right?
Right. Hmm. Yeah, and would you say that as well as, like, the Zeitgeist movement? Because when I saw the first movie, I thought, oh, this is pretty good.
Sure.
When I watched the second one, I went, there's something weird about this.
And the third one was like, what?
Third one, I went, oh, what the hell?
Fuck, yeah.
No, no, no. I don't subscribe to a robot world.
Peter Jay in the in the movie theater in L.A. in 2007 at the premiere of Zeitgeist 1. And I was like, okay, you know, and it's, you know, it's got a lot of good stuff. He'd use even some of my images and stuff in it without really asking me. But, you know, and then when 2 and 3 came out, I'm like, you know, whoa, there's something seriously wrong here. But, you know, in Zeitgeist Part 1, a lot of people will attack it, you know, for Atari S's work in the beginning. And what they don't know, and what nobody ever tells them, and what they totally avoid when they attack it, is that there was actually a Zeitgeist companion that had, like, 35 pages of primary references backing up all of the astrotheology stuff. But, you know, all of these people cite other people who cite other people who cite other people who attacked Atari. And rarely any of them have read one of her books, much less all of them. And then it's like, so you get these tricks. It's like when you're going through and you're looking for evidence of something, okay, well, Atari S is lying. Let's use this as an example. And then you go out and you do your search, and then the next person says, well, Atari S is lying. And then they cite somebody else who said, and then on this page, and you go to that page, and that person says, well, Atari S was lying. But you realize, like, wait, okay, did any of them, one, give page numbers, two, citations and quotes? Is there anything there that I can verify? And you keep going through and you dig through these, and my apologies to Atoria for using her as an example. It just comes to mind. But when you go through all of these, you realize that none of them were based on any primary documentation. So, therefore, you also recognize at the same time, oh, well, she's a liar. Oh, well, that's an ad hominem attack. It's not quoted. It's not cited. They provided nothing to substantiate this argument. It's arguing the arbitrary, so it's automatically thrown out. So this is what makes it so much quicker to use the trivium to get to the truth of the matter in research, because you're not allowing yourself to get hung up emotionally on all of these different ideas and fallacies. You look, okay, here's a statement. Do they back it up? No backups. Is it possible that it's true? Yeah, it's possible, but there's nothing I can verify it here, so I can throw a question mark on it. Throw it in the back of my mind. That's pretty much all I can do with it.
How do you think people get so hooked on these New Age religions, like the Esalen Institute or Scientology, or they get, and how do they fall into that so easily?
Well, you know, see, people are caught in the major religions, and the major religions have been around for thousands of years, and then, you know, they have questions about that. They feel that something isn't right, or whatnot, and then you know they'll fall out of the major religions, and then what happens is, I sort of call it like the second catch web. The elites have sort of set up a second net that people fall into when they fall out of the major religions, and that is the New Age. And the idea is to get people caught into all of this fallacious beliefs and positive thinking and stuff. I mean, obviously, if you think that any information that you haven't studied is negative before you've studied it, I mean, you know, it just makes no sense. You can't judge information before you've seen it. You can't judge it positive or negative, and people would be like, well, that's a conspiracy, that's negative. But, you know, it's like, well, how would you know? And if it saves your life or protects you and your family, isn't that positive? So, you know, this is why it's important to look at information first, then decide its merit, filter the contradictions out of it, look for the support, the, you know, substantiation for the claims, and then make your decision from there. But a lot of people will, you know, well, this person is wrong because they wear pink shirts on Fridays. It's like, okay, really? Wow, that's your whole argument? You know, one of my favorite arguments that people love to make is, you're wrong because...
That's
called an appeal to ridicule. That is the definition of an appeal to ridicule. You're wrong because... And that is actually the intelligence level of most people's arguments. You know, they don't look at, they'll attack you. It's sort of a form of an ad hominem attack. You know, you're a Republican, you're a Christian, you're a, you know, this or that, so anything you say is wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and they'll, you know, they throw their names on it, or they
you don't have a PhD.
Right, you're not, which is an appeal to authority. It doesn't matter if somebody is a PhD or not, if, you know, if the information is correct. They could have simply, you know, how would a PhD go out and verify something, right? And if you know the same process a PhD uses, checking the frickin' citations, it should be just as easy for you to verify something. So what then, you know, it's like, it's an appeal to authority, but it's also an ad hominem attack. They're attacking you and your circumstances, and then they're appealing to authority. We need this false image because I don't trust my own five senses to verify a citation on my own, so I'm going to need a PhD to look at this, you know.
Yeah.
It's essentially somebody who has really low self-esteem and just not the confidence or competence to simply go and verify the citation themselves. You know, and if you and I, you know, if I put a citation in an article and you go to verify that citation, and you open it up and you read it and you read around it and it says it in the context that I claimed it in, then obviously the citation is true and it's proved. You know, so most people don't get that it's that simple to go verify something. And they'll sit there and, you know, well, this is contradictory to everything I've heard before, so you're completely full of shit. Terrence McKenna couldn't have been an agent because I would have known. He would have told me.
Everybody would know
that guy. I know that guy.
And not only that, but he admitted that he was a propagandist for 15 years, and propagandists are paid sophists. They're paid liars. And interestingly, he often identified himself as a bard. Well, a bard is a paid poet of the king who preaches the poets or who preaches the king's accomplishments. And so, you know, when you think of McKenna in terms of admitting that he was a bard or a paid poet of the king, and then you see him admit that he's a propagandist for either the FBI or CIA for 15 years, then you get the whole gig. But, you know, it's, you know, the onus of proof and arguing the arbitrary are such key points to understand. And then, you know, anytime somebody makes a claim, where is their evidence? Are they using name-calling or other fallacies to support it? Oh, there's no fallacies. There's just a citation. I'm going to go check it. Oh, look, the citation checks out or it doesn't. It's true or it's false. You know, 1 + 1 = 2. You can trust your own five senses. Anyone like a Mick Goswami out there telling you that you can't trust your own five senses, they are fooling you, and you should not trust them and this Roger Rabbit quantum physics insane asylum that they want to sell you.
Right. Mm. Can you tell us more about what you learned through your research on the hippie counterculture movement of the 1960s, particularly the musicians of Laurel Canyon?
Well, most of the musicians out of Laurel Canyon were the Sons and Daughters of Intelligence. We have Frank Zappa, who was Frank Zimmerman or whatever. Or no, that was Bob Dylan. And then, well, Jim Morrison was the son of Admiral Morrison, who launched the Gulf of Tonkin incident to drag us into the Vietnam War. Jimi Hendrix, the Byrds, the Mamas and the Papas, all these different bands were involved. You know, their parents were intelligence, you know, basically. And so then what happens is, you know, and in our article we laid all of this out, the manufacturing the deadhead, a product of social engineering. We showed the progression of how Edward Bernays, who is the father of propaganda, and mind you, Gordon Wasson, who discovered magic mushrooms, he was the vice president of propaganda for J.P. Morgan Bank. You know, Terrence McKenna admits that he was in propaganda for the CIA or FBI for 15 years. So these guys, they're all propagandists. They're all, you know, selling this idea of, you know, the social control. Now I just lost the point of your question. Sorry.
Just to talk more about the Laurel Canyon, the musicians came out of it.
Sure, and when you realize, well, and, you know, what's funny is like when you turn on the radio station, like, you know, it's like they have us all in a time machine where the music, most of the music hasn't changed since the mid '60s. You know, here we are, some 50 years on, and most of the music is still the Doors and the Beatles and all of the same damn music over and over and over. They're trying to keep everybody in that mindset, but basically. You know, when you realize that, you know, Laurel Canyon was centered around the intelligence, they basically created these bands. I mean, like, you know, literally just created them, threw people together that had no musical talent whatsoever. Like, the drummer for the Byrds had never played drums before, ever.
Nice.
They literally put him in there and said, oh, you're the drummer of the Byrds. You're the son of agent blah, 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 you know. And he's like, okay, dunk, dunk, man. Man, you know, and so then, you know, they just created these and then they sold it on us. But their idea was to create music idols. And Edward Bernays, you know, brags about his ability to create idols in place of gods in his works that we talk about in that article, Manufacturing the Deadhead.
What is the purpose of psychedelic drugs and how do they affect us?
Wow. Well, that is such a huge question in so many ways. I mean, the purpose of them. There are so many purposes. Ibogaine, you know, some tribes use it for their ceremonies, and it's also used to treat heroin and alcohol addiction. You know, the Mazatec Indians use mushrooms to find lost objects and things like that. You know, the Native Americans use peyote for their ceremonies. It just depends on what you're talking about.
In the context of the New Age movement and the government
The New Age movement and the government, they're psychotomimetics, which means psychosis mimicking. And their goal is to give you an experience that they are going to sell you as religious. Whether or not it is irrelevant to their considerations. But what you then think is a religious experience, they think is a psychotic break, and then they use your time and, you know, in that experience and then afterwards selling you New Age BS to fool you from it. You know, I don't really recommend people go into taking entheogens without first studying the trivium for a couple of years because there are so many different, you know, rabbit holes and just mind control and cults and things to get caught up into, which... You know, a good study of the trivium and logical fallacies will protect you from. But, you know, for the government, they're a way to return us to the ancient, archaic revival, the neo-feudalist, post-modern dark age that they want to steer us into so that they can kill off most of the population of the planet. Then, you know, of course, this solution was created by the same folks who brought the last solution to us that was the problem. So,
right.
You know, I mean, we can't, you know, rather than empowering people and lifting them up, their goal is to fool them, get them to believe that the psychedelic experience is religious, like I said, whether or not it is irrelevant. But I will point out that Oscar Yoniger in 78 or 79, in a conversation on LSD, says that the religious or mystical experience never happened until you cross the Colorado River.
Wow.
And essentially, you know, just to make it clear, what they did was they had to remarket psychedelics. First, they were psychotomimetics, created by some military guy, and then Aldous Huxley was in charge of remarketing them, and Aldous Huxley was CIA. He and Humphrey Osmond were both CIA. They were put in charge of renaming it. Huxley came up with phenotheramine or whatever, and then that doesn't work. It's not marketable, so then they remarket them as psychedelics. Then they hire Timothy Leary to go blow all that up out to the public. He blows it up. Then Wasson, who started the whole thing in the first place in 1956, comes along with Carl Ruck and Jeremy Ott and or John Ott and Jeremy Bigwood, and renames them in the late 70s to Entheogen.
Right.
So, I mean, and I've done them for all of those people out there thinking right now, Jan Ehrman is crazy. He's never taken them before. Well, I've actually studied them for 20 years. I've written books on them, and I've taken them many, 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 many hundreds of times. And I've experienced them through all sides. And the difference is that after I had those experiences, I went out to verify them and went out to verify what the people were saying and realized that a lot of it didn't add up. You know, you don't have to dismiss facts and reality just because you have a spiritual experience. You still live in the real world. You still have to wipe your butt. You still have to put food in your mouth. You know, just because you realize that a sacred feminine exists doesn't mean that you dispose of the sacred masculine.
Right. Okay, so what type of educational system do you see America moving toward?
None.
That's a good answer.
I mean, if it was an education system, then it wouldn't be based on freedom and what people want as individuals. I'm not into groupthink, sorry.
Me neither. I think the teaching yourself is the way to go.
Definitely.
Not into it. It's sort of mob rule. Like, we all decided, we all agreed.
Well, that's what democracy is, rule of the mob.
Yeah.
Not rule by the mob, rule of the mob.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't go to school for 3 years, and I just did it through Skype, so basically I just kind of blew a lot of it off and just studied whatever I wanted. It was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Sure. Well, and I'm an autodidact. I mean, I went to school. I have a stupid degree, but I don't use it really for anything anymore. And
where's your degree?
Electronics and network engineering. So, I mean, it's totally irrelevant. I mean, you can go out there and be an autodidact. Obviously, I work with all of these doctors and have done all this work with doctors and professors from all over the place. And you don't need a degree to do all of this. I mean,
right.
You know, at one point, often you'll realize that doctors kind of get caught in their categories, and they've often been conditioned and don't want to see certain things.
Yes.
You know? And it's not that, you know, everybody should be able to get on the same page and verify information point by point without dismissing it with fallacies or without appealing to authority you know, using a circumstantial ad hominem. You're not a doctor. I shouldn't believe you.
Yeah. Right.
You know what, really fast, I know I said it right up, but since you brought that up, I wanted to ask this question. Do you think, because you went to school in, you're from California, right, Jan? You born and raised?
Oh, I'm not allowed to say.
Okay. But I mean, like, I don't know.
I was born on the moon.
So on the moon.
Where's your evidence?
I don't have any. But you have to just take my word for it. I swear I was born on the moon on my uncle's mother's grave.
Sounds legit. Yeah. Where's the evidence that you have an uncle's mother's relative?
Hey, you're asking way too many questions. Pop it with your who, what, where, when, why, and all that stuff. You're getting me busted here.
So I went to ask, because we were talking about, like, education and conditioning and doctors and stuff. I know different states and different cities might have different,
conditioning,
like,
conditioning and doctors and stuff.
Definitely. what do you think? Do you think gifted, you know what gifted and magnet schools are? Right?
A what?
Gifted and magnet schools.
gifted and magnet schools?
Yeah. Do you think that they were created out of, like, an honest intention to serve the needs of students who need a challenge?
I haven't researched the background. I couldn't make a statement.
Okay.
I don't have any evidence to make a statement one way or the other.
Okay. Got you. Yeah, I was curious if you knew about that.
So. See, and that's what I mean earlier. Like, if you don't have any evidence, you just don't send it downstream. So you just, I don't have the evidence. Boom. Done.
But if I say, okay, let me say this question really fast. Do you think that they were created out of an honest intention to serve the needs of students who needed a challenge, or do you think?
How would I be able to know that without?
Or do you think that they were created as another tool of the divide and conquer strategy to separate humans even more? But if you don't, I mean, can you say that? Okay, I don't have the evidence, but I'm.
I don't have any grammar. I cannot say anything on it with zero grammar.
So you wouldn't even say that that's a possibility?
I wouldn't even say it's a possibility. I have zero grammar to make any decision one way or the other. End of story.
Okay.
He neither confirms nor denies. Okay.
Right. I mean, if I sat down for 10 or 20 minutes and started looking and then found enough to say, you know what, they might be dirty, I'm going to, you know, spend the next couple of days doing background on them, then I could come back in a couple of days and we could have an intelligent conversation about it. But why speculate about things that I pulled from my butt?
Well, I have a question, though, real fast. What is wrong with just saying that maybe it's something is possible, but you
Well, because
sure
you don't have any evidence, so then you know,
but
see,
you
here's
said
the...
It's possible,
let me,
but I don't have any evidence.
Let me make it clearer for you. When you get in to the Strong's Exhaustive Concordance of the Bible and you look up the word Satan...
Mm-hmm.
It's the false accuser. Satan is the false accuser. So, I mean, you know, again, why speculate about how something is that I have zero grammar on? I don't present any information until I get that grammar, because all I'm doing is pulling stuff out of my butt and sending it downstream.
So you're saying...
And then that speculation infects others. It's better not to ever send it downstream until you have the evidence. And then when Sarah or April asked for the evidence, I can say, oh, well, I have this, I have this, I have that, here you go. We can all verify it in the comments. Do you all three agree on these points? Oh, we have a disagreement in terms of a definition of one word. Let's make sure that we have all defined the words that we're using the same so that we're not confused over the word definitions. Okay, now the word definitions are all, we all agree are all the same. Now, are there any contentions left that we're still disagreeing on? Oh, okay, we're all on the same page. Or, oh, you have point B left. Let's go look up point B and get the data on that. Oh, okay, here's the data on that. We can all lay it out, look at it rationally. You know, we don't hold on to it like a religion or whatever. And we can just look at it and say, yes, that's true or false, and then done. But, I mean, there's no reason to speculate about things that I pull from my butt. I mean, it's not even that pretty.
On the fact that I think personally saying that you're open to the possibility of something and then saying, well,
I'm open to the possibility. You're confusing open to the possibility and no evidence to comment.
I'm saying both in the same sentence. I'm open to the possibility, but I can't say that much more on it because I have no evidence. I think that it could be possible, yes, but I have nothing to
doubt. All you do is you end it there. And
yeah.
You don't spread rumors or send anything downstream. You just say, yeah, it's possible, but without any evidence, I can't say.
Yeah, that's what I was doing. That's what I said before. I think it's possible, but I don't, you know, I can't say with conviction. But.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, if I didn't have evidence of something firsthand, I mean, usually you have circumstantial or primary evidence. And let's say, you know, if you're reading something or building a case about something, and let's say you have 20 different angles of circumstantial evidence. That can give you, in a court of law, if you have enough circumstantial evidence, you can actually build a case to get a conviction, et cetera, even without, you know, proving that the person was standing there with a photograph with a gun in his hand or whatever, right? So, you know, but, you know, primary evidence is always going to trump, you know, or is generally going to trump secondhand information or evidence simply because it's in the person's own words and you can verify it right there. But, you know, again, we don't want to just go out and speculate and create things to, you know, we don't send those things downstream. You know, you can put the potential of a possibility, just mark it with a question mark and throw it in the back of your brain until you do get evidence. You know, and then sometimes, you know, a couple years later, you will get evidence and you'll say, damn it, I was right. Cool. Now I have the evidence. Now I can put this on the table in the commons for everybody to view and see if it was right or not. And then, you know, people will reply, and they'll hate you for exposing some truth, and then they'll name call at you and all of this stuff, and then you'd be like, damn, you know, now I found the evidence, now they're name calling at me for doing so, you know.
Right. Yeah, it can be dangerous either way to just make that assumption or to have that sort of speculation without the evidence, because, like, if you take the vaccine issue, for example, which I use because I'm an expert on that now, but, you know, when people come at me and try and say, well, yes, but this has saved lives and this is, you know, we've eradicated diseases, I go, well, there's really, where's your proof? That's really a religious belief, because there, if you actually read the history on it, you actually read it, you realize that that is just a religious belief. So it's dangerous to say, well, I think it could, because people create, when I inject them with this, they have antibodies to fight that. So we think it could prevent disease, but we don't really know. It's possible. And then you just give it to people based on that possibility.
And then you end up with kids with autism and poison everywhere, you know.
Right.
And then, you know, we went to, my son had his first vaccine the week of his third birthday. He had to get the polio vaccine. We were going down to Peru. Shouldn't have gotten it anyway. But 3 days after he got it, when we were down in Peru, he had one of those famous polio vaccine episodes where he lost all motor control of his body for 12 hours. He was like a jellyfish.
God. Wow.
And,
yeah.
You know, and it scared the shit out of me. And then, of course, we called the doctor, and the doctor says, well, maybe it was because you went from high altitude to low altitude. So I started looking around. I'd never heard of anything like this before. Started doing the research on the polio vaccine after I divorced my ex. And sure enough, right there, one of the symptoms of the polio vaccine is loss of motor control, acting like a jellyfish, et cetera. I'm like, oh, you know, so it wasn't because we drove from Cusco down to the coast, which, you know, living here in the mountains in Southern California and driving down the beach had never happened before. So why the hell it would, you know, happen in Peru seemed pretty absurd to me. But then I look up the side effects of the polio vaccine, and they exactly fit the reaction.
Right, and it's the evidence that they actually prevent disease is really just possibility. I mean, if you read their own literature, they say, well, we don't really know. You could still get this disease if we give you this vaccine.
It's possible, but if you take
mushrooms,
you'll elevate to the, you know, the next higher planet of consciousness, or...
Or you could think you're a bird and fly out a window, you know, and try and fly out a window. So there's a danger in, I understand what you're saying, is that there's a danger in saying something's possible.
You just,
because there is
a side effect. You don't send it downstream because it becomes a mental virus. Anything that you send downstream should always be coupled with the evidence.
Right, exactly. So, Jan, thank you so much for being on the show. We've really appreciated
you
coming on and staying long. We had all intentions of having you on a little bit longer than usual because we knew we had so much we wanted to ask you, and we appreciate you being a good sport and talking until the road got dry.
Thank you so much. Tell us where you about your books, your websites, and everything else, so people.
Okay, I've written two books. One is Astrotheology and Shamanism. I co-wrote that with Andrew Rutaji. I have another book, The Holy Mushroom. There's another book I've written that I never published yet, and let's see, I run the Gnostic Media website, triviumeducation.com, johnallegro.org. We have, you know, the Gnostic Media archives, all of the podcasts and everything. We just released our 176th show last night with General Albert Stubblebine, who came out to admit that the work on Aldous Huxley, et cetera, was correct, that I had been digging through. He was the former head of U.S. Army Intel. And we've done a lot of work on there on entheogens and everything, but there's a whole treasure trove of information up there. Really, the key thing that people want to get into is, you know, study the trivium information, form study groups with your friends to do all of that, and also please, you know, help with donations and everything, because we cannot continue doing what we do without the audience support. We have no commercials, no corporate affiliations whatsoever.
Awesome.
Well, there you have it. That is awesome. And Jan, thank you so much. And you're our milestone show too, because this is going to be number 50 for us. And so
you're going to be our 50th. Yes.
Yeah, we put you in that special spot. Yeah. Don't you feel good?
How about that?
Feel the pressure. Feel the pressure.
Yeah. Well, I waited till the end to tell you.
Yeah, wait a minute.
There'd be no pressure to make this totally awesome, but you have. So thank you so much, and we really appreciate you being on. And we're going to take a short break, me and the ladies, and when we get back, we're going to talk about Jan behind his back. No, we'll thank him for being on the show. and enjoy the rest of your day. All right.
Thank you. Have a good day, ladies. Enjoy.
Bye-bye.
I was on holiday with Sir Laurence Olivier. We had decided that 9/11 was an intelligence operation. We'd all known about JFK. He had so many mistresses. The CIA shot him. Castro could never have done it. It was clear we had become realists, conspiracy realists. How would we let everyone know was the question. We decided to buy T-shirts that told the contents of our hearts and minds to the world. We went to shop.truthertees.com. Even though the internet hadn't been invented at the time, we went to shop.truthertees.com. There, we purchased Conspiracy Realist T-shirts, one of a kind, sold only at shop.truthertees.com. 100% cotton in men's and women's fitted sizes. I won't tell you which one I'm wearing.
So
we just finished interviewing Jan Ervin from Gnostic Media. Yeah, it was great. It was very
interview.
Yeah, it got a little.
So much information.
I know we didn't. We're gonna if he wants to come back, we got like through half our questions basically. But,
I know.
We would love to have him back if he's willing to. Maybe on a later date. Maybe we can pick a more specific topic, and have him just talk about that because he has so many different things that he's very knowledgeable about.
Yeah, let's ask what he wants to talk about.
Yeah.
Hopefully he'll come back because we talked him to death and he had to like walk away and get a drink of water. Everyone's there talking to her.
Apologize, you guys. It's still a little bad because I feel like there was a part where it got really intense because we were kind of going back and forth.
A little heated,
but I wasn't gonna. I respect him, and it
was a good discussion. I mean,
to get to the point where we're gonna like call each other names or anything, and I totally really did see his point of view because, I guess what he was saying is if you subscribe to everything that's out there without really doing your due diligence, then you basically kind of end up in the same position that you were in before. And there are people in this truth movement, they realize that they've been lied to, and then they go and they read all these other things, and they kind of fall down, the same path because they're not, really using their critical thinking skills. Seeing one, I guess, really for me to have evidence to prove, I'd have to capture one or capture somebody on tape.
Right.
Turning into an alien. I don't know how I would do that. But if it comes out that they are, I wouldn't be, like, shocked,
No, I wouldn't be shocked. There was, I was walking outside a little while ago, there was a lizard on the wall, and I swear he looked just like Dick Cheney. I was like, are you related? Are you his cousin or something like that? No, I'm kidding.
It was like a ass. It was Donald Rumsfeld.
Cheney-ish, More Cheney, Dick Cheney, I'm pretty sure, if anybody, at all.
Yeah.
No,
if you look at David Rockefeller or any of the Rockefellers, you're like, what is going on? How many?
Either they're in reptilian or they're inbred or something. They're just,
or both.
Or they're just so, like, ugly on the inside that it makes them ugly on the outside.
Or they've whatever. Too many babies. There's that.
Yeah, it's eating the babies.
Yeah, we make jokes. And then I'm like, oh, what if I offended a reptilian? Like I'm being like racist toward reptilians.
Yeah, I'm not really worried about that. If they exist, show yourself to me, and then I'll be like, oh, bro, I'm sorry.
Sorry, dude.
That was my bad, But if you don't show yourself to me, I get what he's saying. If you don't have the evidence, then because I get like that a lot in the truth movement because everybody blames everything on HAARP, I think. Where's the evidence that this is
actually happening?
Well, or not even just evidence, like proof. You need some kind of proof, a little bit. But people will just, and going back to the David Icke thing, I think it's interesting when Jan, we asked him, and I would have asked him another question, but I took mercy on him because I know he was exhausted from all of our questions. The David Icke thing is interesting because David Icke actually claims that he had a psychedelic type of awakening through the use of acid or LSD or something like that.
I think it was ayahuasca.
Really? Well, okay.
Gary. He had some sort of awakening through this, and that's part of why he believes that he's he saw this, and he knows that everybody, that they're all reptilians. But I mean,
wait, and I'm not,
it works, you know. I think it definitely
is a metaphor. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I could use it as a metaphor all day long. That's like, oh yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But I mean, but we don't know if it's true. And so it's the same with the alien thing. It's like a lot of people are really stuck on the, you know, this whole alien cover-up. And I just don't know what to do with that. You know what I mean? I'm like, I got a lot of problems, or there's so many problems that are out there that are easily provable. The vaccine issue, Sarah and I can attest, is easily provable.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And we know it's right there. And so it's like I choose to take issue with the things that are obvious.
Or the things you have control over, too, because I can't, there's
yeah.
no, I can't really... Like I said, it's possible, but I don't, like, I'm not stuck on it. I'm not, like, trying to get them to expose themselves as aliens. I don't care. We basically know who they are, who the people, who the elite is, and what, who the people are that are controlling and manipulating us, you know? And also, at the same time, if you're looking, you know, for an outside solution, I was saying, you know, when he brought that up, that doesn't help either. You got to take responsibility somewhere. And if you have something like the Trivium, where you can break things down logically and you can analyze them and you can present evidence, you don't, it's harder for you to be manipulating and controlling to get lost.
Yeah, exactly. And it was that was the point I was making about the Zeitgeist thing too, is that in the whole Zeitgeist movement, you know, he gets into this whole, well, you guys don't have to do anything. You're not going to have to work for the rest of your life. You're going to have robots taking care of things. And I'm going, who's controlling them robots?
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
no, it's okay.
So, but, you know, it's, I mean, in that, I saw this one guy, and he was saying people who fall into that are fluff because they don't want to take responsibility for their lives and just, you know, work and get their hands dirty and things like that. Because why else would you want to believe in something like that? It's we have no proof. It's just these guys, this guy drew these nice designs and these pretty pictures of, you know, houses on the ocean and things like that. But we don't have in engineering, there's no, where's the plan, where's the structure, how's it going to actually happen? So.
And then, but still, it, like you said, who controls the robots? If that still happens, it's
right.
Like you're putting in yourself, you're basically putting us in a better Brave New World, you know,
yeah,
like nicer
your,
architecture. Like that.
Giving
that,
up your free will.
Like that episode To Serve Man. Do you ever see that Twilight Zone episode?
Yeah.
Have you seen that, Sarah? You watched
no,
the Twilight
I haven't.
Zone? I will send it to you, but it's about, you've probably seen pictures of it, like these aliens come down, people are like freaking out, and then they're like, hey, chill out, dude, we come in peace. And the one dude, the main alien's carrying like this book. So then they realize that other aliens have this book that they carry around with them all the time. So they're able to steal a copy and give this book to a translator. So basically this episode is told through the story of a translator who's trying to translate this book and figure out what it means. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you know, like years or months, however long they go by, and they're like, you know, telling the public, they're like, oh, you know, we came down and we saw that you guys were having trouble and you have war and you have racism and you have, you know, your resources and how you know, all the problems basically that we have. And they're just basically saying, oh, we want to help you. So, you know, why don't you just chill out, come to our planet? You know, we have malls, we have all this great stuff. And, but first of all, you have to give up all your weapons. So they sign peace treaties. They dispose of all guns and all nuclear weapons and all this stuff, right? So come to find out, basically, everybody's basically just suckered up into going to space because they're cannibals. But
right.
They're appealing to the fluff. They're appealing to the people
right.
that don't want to do anything. They're just looking for a quick fix. And it's not possible, you know.
Right, yeah. Then once you realize that, it's, you're going to have to get your hands dirty and you're going to have to learn how to build a house and plant a garden and do your own things. Just get over it. Like that's, it's going to be hard. It's not going to be easy. So just get into it and, you know, stop looking for an easy way out because it's not there. And if you,
it's,
if someone
there,
cleans
it's
over,
going to be more fulfilling. It's going to be more fulfilling
someone,
in the end too.
It will
yeah.
be. And if somebody, someone claims that there is, then chances are they are trying to, they're a snake oil salesman trying to sell you some shit.
Right.
So that's all I'm going to say about that. But anywho, Jan Irvin, 50th episode. This has been really, really fun, and I wish we could go on and
amazing.
On and on. But
amazing.
We're out of time. And I want to thank everybody for listening. Please don't forget to check out our website at truthortalk.com. We have everything in one location now, and we are so grateful to Jan Irving. We're so grateful to Sarah Sotomayor. Sarah, give us your website again.
sarahshealingjourney.wordpress.com.
There it is, you guys, Sarah's Healing Journey. sarahshealingjourney.wordpress.com. And you can find us at Truth or Talk. As always, we want to end the show with peace, truth, and love.
Peace, truth, and love, you guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.